Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and unfortunately, my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host Stephen Gordon is a little under the weather this evening and will not be with us. So I'm going to go ahead and just bring out our guest. I'm very pleased to welcome Ramez Nam to the program. Ramez has been described as, quote, the only serious successor to Michael Crichton. He was born in Cairo, Egypt, and came to the U.S. at the age of 3. He's a computer scientist who spent 13 years at Microsoft leading teams working on email, web browsing, search, and artificial intelligence. He holds almost 20 patents in those areas. Mez is the winner of the 2005 H.G. Wells Award for his nonfiction book, More Than Human, Embracing the Promise of Biological Enhancement. He's worked as a lifeguard, has climbed mountains, backpacked through the remote corners of China, and ridden his bicycle down hundreds of miles of the Vietnam coast. He lives in Seattle, where he writes and speaks full time. His new book is called Crux. It's the second in a series that began with Nexus last year and that I suspect will carry on into a new book next year. So he's here to tell us all about that. Ramez, welcome to The World Transformed.
Phil, it's great to be back.
Great to have you back with us. You know, it seems like you were just here. You're cranking these things out, aren't you?
I am. They're going to slow down a little bit, I think. I had a backlog of books, but I'm trying to write as fast as I can.
Well, you can't make them fast enough. I can tell you that much. I finished Crux late last night, and I immediately want to read the next book. I can tell you that much. I'm raring to go. Not to say that it's not a completely satisfying novel in and of itself, but it's got that Empire Strikes Back feel to it. We completed a story, but we feel that the larger arc still has places to go, and I assume there's. Well, a third. We'll get into it. We'll talk about what your plans are for the future. I want to talk about Crux both as a book, and I was hoping we could kind of get into some of the philosophical themes. But before we go there, I promised an update on the world's longest book, The World Transformed, our new e-book project that we're working on. We talked about that on the program last week. And Mez, since you are both an author and an advisor to the project, I thought I would give you an update as our one of two member advisory board. I can tell you that we've got another member of the advisory board now. John Smart has agreed to serve on the board along with you, and we'll be looking for one or two other people to serve in that capacity. And take a guess, since last week, how many authors do you suppose we've signed up?
5.
18. We've got.
OMG! Awesome.
We've got 18 authors signed up, and now I'm looking, and I see this isn't the complete list. But let me just read it off. This is whenever we did the World Transformed special series. This was the thing we always did leading up to it was read off everyone who we had signed on to participate in the preceding week. And so last week we already talked about Phil and Steven and, you know, Ray and Ramez, so no big deal on those guys. But now let me add to the list. We've got Aubrey de Grey, our old co-host Michael Darling, George Dvorsky, Sonia Arison, Tobias Buckow, Nikola Danilov, Alvis Bridges, Natasha Vita Moore, Dave Goebel, John Smart, of course, Maria Konovalenko, Aurelien Carpathia, and Are You Serious are all on board now doing the show and doing the book. And there's one other, because that only adds up to 17 as I read down that list. And I will update that on the blog later for those of you.
That's an amazing list already. Aubrey de Grey, maybe the world's top person in the science of longevity, and Sonia Arison, who's an amazing futurist herself, and George Dvorsky, who writes such great stuff for Io9, and Tobias Buckow is a great sci-fi author. I mean, that's a fantastic list you've got right there.
Yeah, great bunch. Well, you know, as Stephen and I were saying last week, we got a pretty deep bench here on the World Transform. Folks who've been on the show and who are excited about talking about the future and excited about getting other people interested in developing their own ideas about the future. So, yeah, I've been really pleased by the response so far, and it's a real honor and privilege to have folks like yourself and them working on this with us. I think it's just going to be fantastic fun as we move ahead on this thing.
Awesome.
I can tell you also that although I haven't published up on worldtransform.org all the official specifics, we do have a rough timeline now. We've decided that we're going to try to get the first 99 chapters of the abridged edition collected by the end of the year, and hopefully have the online environment working by the end of the first quarter of 2014. We'll do our crowdfunding campaign that we're looking to put a little bit of juice behind getting the word out about this starting in a couple of months. We're hoping to start that sometime in November and actually launch the book, have that be published sometime in Q2 of 2014. So we're taking a page from your book, Ramez, on fast book production here. We're going to see if we can't make this thing happen in a remarkably quick period of time, because I think the future is all about acceleration, don't you think?
Fantastic.
So that's the update on that. Let's talk a little bit of Crux. Now, this is the sequel to Nexus, and why don't you, since you're the author and you know what's fair to give away and what you want to not spoil, why don't you give us your quick synopsis of what happened in Nexus and now what happens in what Crux is all about?
Sure. So Nexus is a near future thriller. It's set in the year 2040, which sounds awfully far in the future, but it's 27 years, which is as far forward as 1986 is behind us. So it's not really that far forward.
Is that right?
Technology.
We're as close to 2040 as we are to 1986. Wow.
I know. It's not really that far, actually.
That blows
my
mind.
So I'm not envisioning there's no aliens. There's no bases on Mars, sad as that is. It's set on Earth in a society that looks a lot like today, but the key technologies that are different are sort of, you know, biotech, nanotech, infotech, the information technologies and technologies itself. And in particular, there's this technology that's being packaged and sold as a drug called Nexus. It's really this nanotechnology that gets in your brain, attaches to your neurons, and as Cory Doctorow described it, if you and I both have it, it gives us sort of a weak telepathy. Basically, these nano devices that attach to your neurons transmit via Wi-Fi. And this technology has awesome potential for positive use, but technologies like it have been used for terrible things like mind control, and so it's highly illegal. And my protagonists are young, idealistic scientists in San Francisco who are trying to work on making it better. Versus my other protagonist is an agent of a government agency, not unlike the Department of Homeland Security or the NSA, who is chartered for very good reasons in her mind with stopping such technologies, which brings them into conflict. And then there's Buddhist monks and explosions and AI uploads and stealth submarines and clone soldiers and cyborg ninjas and underground dance parties and black markets of biotech goods in Bangkok and all the normal stuff that you throw into a science fiction novel, in my opinion.
Everything you need, absolutely. And I'll add some totally righteous fight scenes, okay? Just some
excellent.
It's like, wow, I can't put this down until I find out what happens here kind of stuff. Actually, I felt that way generally about both of those books. But the suspense in some of those, especially the kind of detailed combat sequences, is really quite riveting. It really is.
Thanks. It's sort of a Tom Clancy meets William Gibson meets Burning Man sort of mashup.
Exactly. And you pull it off, too. Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. The first book was written to be self-contained. I didn't know if there would be a sequel when I wrote it. And the publisher bought two sequels. So the first book has an ending. The ending changes the world a little bit. And the second book picks up where the first one, or a few months after the first one, and kind of explores how the world has changed for good and bad, shows very positive things happening with this technology and very terrible things happening with this technology. And in an odd sort of way, all the stuff that's come to light with the NSA and the debate on government surveillance and so on sort of is mirrored in the book, even though I wrote it before any of this stuff happened. It's not literally the same stuff. It's not the NSA that we're really dealing with in the book. But similar topics and themes run throughout the book. How much control should there be? How much surveillance should there be? What sort of back doors into communication and encryption should there be? And that's sort of a constant thread through it. So if you like the first book, the second one kind of just runs with the same stuff, though different, kind of amps it up a little bit more. And it is, as you said, it's The Empire Strikes Back. It's going to be a third book, and then I'm going to be done. I'm going to at least close up that story and move on to their stuff. And so the second one is actually a little bit darker, some bad things happen, and it ends a storyline as well, but it definitely leaves you with a little bit of a sense of unease at the end, I think.
If you don't mind me saying, some absolutely horrifying things happen, okay, in my opinion. Some really not just like, you know, bad in terms of violent or scary, but things that are creepy, you know? I mean, things that are, you think about that and you go, ooh, that's disturbing. The stuff that nightmares are made of, I think, but in a good way, you know, in a highly edge of your seat kind of thriller way. You know, you mentioned the NSA stuff, and I think that's an excellent point. I got to tell you, I was always a big fan of The X-Files, one of my favorite TV shows ever. And one of the things I always loved about that show was, to me, it was just kind of kitschy or campy or whatever, the whole paranoid thing about this vast government conspiracy and, you know, the truth is out there and they're out to get you, you know, it's just kind of cute and entertaining, right, to picture the government that way. And in light of, I guess, the news over the last, I don't know, 6 months or so, has it been? It just doesn't seem all that funny anymore, you know? I mean, it's like, wow, you know, that's too close to reality. And I've always thought of fiction in this genre, you know, where you have some of that kind of stuff going on. I always think, well, this is, you know, you suspend your disbelief because it's got to be larger than life. Everything that happens has to be a little bit larger than life. But I don't know, life has gotten pretty large, hasn't it, where that sort of thing is concerned.
It's true. And, you know, I have a rule, which is that for the most part, in fiction, I don't think there are that many scheming, maniacal villains. $1 billion, I want to conquer the world. And so my quote-unquote villains, or my antagonists, actually, the people who are fighting, mostly aren't even villains. They are people who have different views of what is right. And they're not. There's not even just two sides. There's like four or five different viewpoints in the book of different characters that really don't – none of them see things quite the same way, and they're all trying to achieve the goals that they think are the right thing. Now, some of them work in the government and are willing to use the power of government resources to get their way. And some of them are involved in, you know, things that we would call conspiracies. And even though I try to, like, give them as much backstory and give them noble motivations and show exactly as much as I can why they think what they think and why they're doing what they're doing for the highest motivations that I can ascribe to them, I still feel like I'm exaggerating. I don't think this stuff really happens in real life. Right. And then the NSA stuff comes out, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, maybe I'm not exaggerating that much.
Yeah, maybe you're not. Yeah, this.
So, yeah.
Eerily prophetic, perhaps. Yeah, that's.
I feel every day I'm writing a little bit more nonfiction than fiction, or like I have written more nonfiction than fiction.
Well, I'll tell you, the three things I would say about the book, because you know me, I would love to just kind of spoil the end for everyone, but my comments on Crux are it works absolutely as just an edge of your seat thriller, just a book you can't put down and just read because you want to find out what happens next. It totally works on that level. It also works, I think, as a glimpse into a highly plausible future and a very well thought out and well defined future where the parts all kind of work together. And then it works on this third level, which is what makes it just awesome for me, which is it's the exploration of some really significant issues that not a lot of people are dealing with. And these are big issues that we deal with on this program that are dealt with generally within the accelerating change, the singularity, the transhumanist community, but maybe that the public at large is only sort of becoming aware of. So I thought what we'd do this evening is let's just spend some time talking about what I've identified as three of the big issues that surface in Crux and delve a little deeper into those, if that's okay with you.
Excellent.
Okay. Here are the three that I picked up. The first is mind control. I'm going to talk a little bit about mind control. Mm-hmm. And then I want to talk a little bit about the individual versus the collective when it comes to intelligence. Yep. And when it comes to minds. It seems like that's a huge issue. And then the whole idea of a human versus post-human war, the idea of conflict between those two. So those are the three big themes that I'd like to touch. And let's start by talking about mind control. Now, as you mentioned, Nexus wasn't necessarily invented with that application in mind. Certainly, our hero Cade wasn't thinking mind control when he develops Nexus 5, but it does enable that, and it's not just mind control, it's body control, right? It's taking it's taking over somebody's nervous system completely. You can make them say and do, and this is where it gets very creepy. Even think and feel whatever you want them to think and feel. Now, I guess my first question about that is obviously this doesn't exist yet, thank goodness. But are there analogs to this capability today? Are there things that you can look at and say this is how we know we're heading in that direction?
There are analogs, and then I'll expand it out really broadly to say kind of why I wrote that the way I did. There are certainly analogs today, and many of us are mostly comfortable with them, but then they raise some issues. So here's an analog. We hear about this thing called chemical castration, which is if you're a sex offender, you've gone to jail, you have committed some crime, you have abused children is probably the most classic crime, and then you serve your sentence in jail. Then after you're released, after you have served the sentence that you've been convicted of and assigned to, then a not uncommon thing, it's only allowed in some states, not in others, and there's various lawsuits and civil liberties issues around it, is this thing called chemical castration, where you're given a drug that renders you physically impotent and lowers libido on the notion that this reduces the likelihood or renders it perhaps almost impossible that you will be a sex offender again. And that is not a broad use of mind control. It's neither broad in what it does to the mind, nor is it broad in how it's used in society. It affects a small set of people, and it does a fairly narrow thing to them.
Right.
But nevertheless, there's some civil libertarians who are like, I'm not sure that's a great idea. Here's a somewhat broader version of that.
It's interesting with that one. It affects a group of people with whom people are least likely to have any sympathy or to.
There's
give
not
around,
a lot of sympathy
right?
for child abusers. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Not for people who sexually abuse children. That's probably the group that has the least sympathy in society. What I understand is that even inside of prisons, they're the people who have the least sympathy.
Right. Yeah. They're at the bottom of the social order. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So more controversial than that is the prescription rates of ADHD drugs to kids in school.
Right.
So now we have, kids as young as 5 or 6 or 7 being prescribed drugs like Ritalin. And, I'm a pretty successful person. I've had a great career in software, and I managed to turn out these books. I guarantee you that if I was a kid, as I behaved as a kid now, I would be diagnosed with ADHD.
Right.
And the techniques used with parents are sort of coercive. Like, parents are told basically, almost like you have to give your kid this drug if you want them to stay in this classroom or stay
right.
in this school. Again, it varies on the school and the classroom. And, it's not like we're not telling them, we're not controlling the content of your kid's thoughts. We're not saying your kid can't think certain things. But we are, in a slightly broader sense, for a much larger set of people, we are doing something that affects the mind and the brain. And it's almost undoubted that we're overdiagnosing ADHD, that some of what we call ADHD, especially in kids, is just what we would have called being kids. And a lot of
right.
kids who have ADHD don't have it for life. They literally grow out of it and become functional, human adults. There's another backstory of this that is more where the mind control angle comes from. Of course, this is explored a lot in other fiction and so on. One of the guys who first started the work on brain-computer interfaces in humans was a scientist named Jose Delgado. So two guys, Jose Delgado and Robert Heath in the 1960s, actually did a bunch of work with sticking electrodes into the brains of various animals, including primates. And they could do things like make a monkey fall asleep at will, wake up at will, become hungry, become satiated, become aggressive, become docile. Delgado, the more flamboyant of the two, has this great video of, he gets in a bull ring with a brave bull, a bull that's been trained for a bullfight. He gets the bull to, charge him. He waves, the cape at it. The bull charges him, and he pushes a button on the remote control in his hand, and the bull just skids to a halt and then cowers in fear and runs away from him. Okay. If you go to my website, ramesnam.com, you can find a video of me at Google talking about this stuff and showing this tech, and I've got this video of this thing happening. But so Delgado and Heath, his collaborator, funded in part by the CIA's MK Ultra program, which sounds like a conspiracy theory, but a real program, the same program that gave LSD to soldiers to see what could happen, because they actually did experiment with mind control back then, and none of it really worked. But this came the closest. These guys also, in those days, there was very little protection for patients in insane asylums. So they did all sorts of creepy stuff, including, in one case, taking a gay male patient in an insane asylum, hooking him up with a electrode that went into part of his caudate nucleus that basically stimulates pleasure, hiring a female prostitute to come in and perform sexual acts on him while they repeatedly stimulated his pleasure center to see if they could switch his sexual orientation, which failed. So that was kind of creepy. That was more than kind of creepy. That was horrifically creepy. Delgado wrote this book called Physical Control of the Mind, where he argued that we could improve on society, again, from high-minded ideals. He really thought this was the right thing. We could improve on society by doing things like fitting criminals with implants, with electrodes in their brains that were remote-controlled that would reduce their ability to commit crime. Mm. And now you're talking about mind control.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. And that's the... That's the real, it seems to me, shadow that looms somewhere here. Because in the book, the mind control that is used is, you know, there's this drug nexus, and you take the back door and you get in and you get a hold of somebody's mind. But so it's all kind of somebody has to figure out the key, and it wasn't set up to do that in the first place. But it seems that, you know, the real danger from this kind of technology would be if you had a government or some other entity that forces the control mechanism, whatever it would be, onto the populace at large, or to members of the population that they feel need to be straightened out, and, you know, pretty much they could do whatever they want with them. Do you think that the first implementation of something Nexus-like that we see in the real world, frighteningly, might be something along those lines?
I don't really think so. I think that in general, we have much more respect for civil liberties now than we did back in the 60s. And so we're very...
Well, I didn't necessarily mean here, but just... do you think that might happen someplace?
No, I think that mostly, I mean, the real development of technologies like this is really happening for medical reasons and research reasons for neuroscience. So I think that's where it will really come from. So I'm not, as much as I write about these horrific uses, I don't really worry about them so much. I wrote about them in part because I wanted to set up this prohibitionist sort of scenario in the book. In part, and here's where I want to expand on the mind control thing. There's this debate about technology, and there's kind of techno-optimists and techno-pessimists. And I'm mostly a techno-optimist. I'm clearly a techno-optimist. But I'm a techno-optimist who realizes that while the world is the best it's ever been, humanity is in the best place it's ever been, modulo some very large risks that we have. Even so, humanity is in the best place it's ever been, and that's largely due to our progress with technology. That doesn't mean that every technology is all good. In fact, every technology we've invented, just about, has some downsides. So we invent cars, and then there's car accidents. We invent the electric light, and people get killed by electricity, or there's carbon emissions from the coal-fired plants, or whatever. So I wanted to show you that every tech has some downsides. And one of the worst things you can do is to overreact to those downsides and get so worried about them that you crack down, because that then creates its own set of problems. And so I invented this backstory where these terrible things had happened, where there had been something, a virus, a biotech you could use that would weaken people's will, called communion virus, and somebody had used it to create a Waco-style cult, and that had led to hundreds of people dying, and so that had led to prohibitions on various kinds of neurotech. And there had been a drug created called a DWITY, do what I tell you, that also just weakens sort of people's wills. And that's actually not that implausible, actually, and that had been misused to kidnap people and steal their money and so on. So there had been a lot of crackdowns on neurotech, but that the crackdowns themselves had maybe gone too far because they had prohibited positive uses as well.
Right, and the other thing that creates that kind of prohibition-like atmosphere in the book is also just the fear of the differentness of people who have taken on these kinds of capabilities. Because it's really interesting when you start talking about some of the mind control kind of stuff. And one of the reasons that I think we're pretty well inoculated from that sort of thing is when you talk about that book that, you know, where somebody says, you know, we'll get the right people together and they'll decide the modifications that need to be made and we'll fix humanity, right? Most of us, or enough of us, are, you know, totally turned off by that. You know, the buzzers start going off. Enough of us are wary of that, suspicious of that, scared of that, that we know not to go in that direction. But actually, if you flip it around, the whole transhuman movement has to do with people trying to make really interesting changes to themselves, some of which might even be some of the same kinds of things that someone else might try to force on you. You know what I mean? Like behavioral change is not unlike what you might try to accomplish with Ritalin. Or even, I don't know, you know, I have friends who talk about just completely not having a sex drive anymore. They would rather not have one. I personally can't imagine that. I think that's just kind of weird. But yeah. You know, that's part of the whole transhuman picture is that you know you would be able to change any part of yourself, and that's fine, right? As long as somebody's making the decision for him or herself as far as where they want to go. But it's the differentness of people who have, you know, taken on that power. And there's almost something kind of it reminds me a little bit of the witch hunt kind of feel, right? Like these people are uncanny. It's almost kind of like in the X-Men, right? The sort of superstitious dread that they seem to feel towards these people who have the Nexus drug in them.
Yeah, there's definitely an element of X-Men in Nexus, especially when we deal with there's plot threads of children that have been born with Nexus in their brains because their pregnant mothers took it, and that certainly has that element. I think that there is an element of that, and there is a large extent of fearing the new, especially when it comes to biological things. Nobody really fears the newest tablet or smartphone or airplane or laptop or whatever. But when in vitro fertilization was invented, and now it's nearly 30 years ago, Time magazine's cover was test tube babies.
Right.
And boy, was that a scandal and a big disruption in society. When Dolly the sheep was cloned, my God, you know, that kept hundreds of bioethicists paid for years to just writing the same hand-wringing stories about it forever. Stem cells, the same sorts of things. We haven't really made any progress on human genome engineering, but as we get closer to the technological work that actually makes that feasible, and that's, you know, we'll start to see some progress that makes that feasible again in another few years, another 5-8 years, I think, you'll see a huge amount of hand-wringing around that as well. So the biological changes, for whatever reason, drive a whole lot more. And Nexus, while it is a nanotech, because it's invasive, because it's part of the body, I think it hits on those quick triggers much more like a biotech than like a laptop or a tablet.
Right. But one other thought on mind control before we move on to the other two. This very disturbing possibility in Crux, we run into this one character who has this whole entourage who seem to have willingly given themselves over to his control. So you've got mind control, but people have submitted to it, and presumably it's because this guy makes it worth their while. Apparently Nexus, you know, makes it easy to hand a good deal of bliss off in return for essentially becoming a slave. And come to think of it, I think for a lot of people, you know, for anybody, actually, that might sound kind of appealing in some ways. How would you like to be happy all the time and don't worry, you don't have to worry about anything, you just do what I say and, you know, life's going to be great. And you get to wondering if, you know, is there a big scary future where the mind control scenario isn't so much about the government coming in and you know, jacking you up with this stuff, but rather people willingly giving themselves over to Big Brother. Is that a real fear, do you think?
Well, you know, I actually wish that I had been able to spend more time on that character and that scenario, because I would love to play with that one, because a lot of my goal in the book is to not present black and white, but present the things that make you think and make you a little bit uncomfortable or make you question your belief set a little bit. And so, I do think it's different if someone voluntarily, you know, hands power over themselves over to someone else, than if a third party takes that power without consent. I might not think it's the wisest decision. It might not be a decision that I personally admire or would want to make, though you can imagine situations where you would make it. To a small extent, we make that choice when we go to work for someone else.
Exactly.
And it's a trade-off that we make. You know, it's you're trading off a certain amount of your time and your mental energy and your physical energy and your life in exchange for what you get. I actually think I'd recommend another book, which is John C. Wright. His books, The Golden Age and the two books that follow that, deal also not as much as I would like, but they have they deal with a very advanced neurotech. It's at 10,000 years in the future. But one of the types of entities that you encounter there are agglomerations of people where literally thousands or tens of thousands of people have willingly given up their minds to be subsumed into a composite mind that's running across all of their brains. And I found that idea fascinating. People would be would find it a positive trade-off. They would feel this togetherness. They would no longer feel alone. They would no longer have a sense of insecurity. They'd always have the sense of belonging. And in exchange, they just wouldn't, as an individual, they wouldn't really be in charge anymore. So I don't think that's that illegitimate, though I did make that character creepy and sleazy in the book.
Well, he's not a good guy, that's for sure. But yeah. He's a very interesting character.
He's not the worst guy in the book either.
No, he's not. Oh, no. No. Well, that would be fun. After everyone listening has read it, we'll sit down and talk about who's best and who's worst, because it's quite a range. Quite a lineup you got there.
That is a very large range. I don't know.
Although I think I know who's worst, but I won't say. But I think we all know.
I'm not.
If you read it,
I'm not sure I can say who's worst.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you. I'll tell you when we're offline. I'll send you an email.
Okay.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But
okay.
Let's actually the idea of the conglomeration of intelligence that takes us right to the next one, which is this individual and collective intelligence versus individual and collective minds, because there's a slight difference there. And, you know, one of the really cool things about Nexus is that it allows you to learn anything you need to know pretty much instantaneously as long as the software exists. We have this one of the great recurring – it's almost a running gag in the two books is the Bruce Lee program, this bit of software that theoretically – like Neo in The Matrix, Cade now has the ability to be this martial arts master. Well, things don't always work out exactly right. I won't give too much away. But basically, the idea is, hey, I need to know Kung Fu. Boom, I load the program. Now I know Kung Fu. That's one great way to learn with Nexus. But there's this now we learn about this other way, which is we see people using Nexus to learn via direct mind interface, and there's really interesting sequences where kids are drawing on each other's knowledge. And they're able to answer questions. And as soon as they start using the knowledge from someone else, then it becomes their knowledge too. And there's this suggestion that capability might be crucial for us as a species going forward. That might be the thing about Nexus that kind of makes it makes the people who are using it truly the next step in evolution. So my question is, how far are we from both of those kinds of learning in the real world? Are there reasons to think that both of those things are possible and on their way?
Yeah, so early on in Nexus, actually, there's an argument between Cade, you know, who's one of the developers of this technology, and Sam, who's the agent who's been sent to stop him, about the purpose of this technology, whether it's good or bad. And Cade quotes Einstein, you know, who said the problems we currently face can't be solved at the same level of thinking that we were at when we created them. And Cade's talking about Nexus as a way to boost our level of thinking by connecting more minds. And that's firmly what he believes in. And Sam's thinking of it as, my God, this is a way to totally screw everything up instead. So the way that in the book, the Bruce Lee program doesn't really teach you Kung Fu. Instead, it's a bot running on your mind, on your brain, that uses an interface to directly, you know, control your motor cortex and tell your limbs where to go. And it runs into various problems, like your muscles aren't actually any stronger than they were before you loaded this program, and you haven't, like, worked on your muscle memory, so you're still kind of an uncoordinated kid. If you were an uncoordinated kid before. So it has various limitations that Neo doesn't. We have already boosted our ability to create collective intelligence. So collective intelligence is something that has existed for a long, long time. And I talk about this, I muse about this in both books quite a bit, that everything that makes humans special, not everything, but the majority of what makes humans special isn't just our individual intelligence. It's our ability to work together, right? So we say, like, why is a human why are humans the top of the food chain, the top of the evolutionary ladder, let's say? That's not quite the right metaphor, but why are humans kind of the dominant species on Earth and not, say, grizzly bears? Grizzly bears are way stronger and tougher than us. A human versus a grizzly is, you know, way more obviously the grizzly wins. This is because they're smart, right? Okay, take a really smart human, put them in the woods, give them a year, give them a decade, and put them up against a grizzly. The grizzly is probably still going to win, actually. Maybe if they're an exceptionally clever human. So what really gave humans the advantage over other species was the ability of humans not just to use their individual intelligence, but to collaborate. So language, you know, real modern symbolic language seems to have arisen in human brains and human societies about 100,000 years ago. And that was a huge step forward. And we can see cave art comes into existence, multi-part tools that are kind of a new level of sophistication come into existence. Standardization of tools comes into existence. People start to communicate. If before that, people were kind of crudely copying each other's tools. No two tools are exactly alike. Now, suddenly, at about the 100,000-year mark, tools start to be built in exactly the same way, one after the other. And that's a sign, even at sites hundreds of miles apart, that's a sign that humans are now able to verbally tell each other, no, first you do step one, then step two, then you put the ochre on, then you tie the twine like this, then you strike it like this, yada, yada, yada. And that is collective intelligence, right? And then, you know, writing, and then printing, and then the internet, and then, you know, blah, 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 with Nexus being the obvious extension of that. Are we getting to the point of actually being able to beam thoughts into our head? We are still quite a ways from that. And I'll talk about the science that makes it look somewhat plausible in a sec, but I just want to say that even though the science of Nexus itself is awesome, and even though it's still decades in the future, I don't view it as anything other than an extension of all the steps we've already taken, from going from grunts to verbalizations to actually being able to write things down to creating a printing press that made it faster to the internet and YouTube and, like, how-to videos on YouTube. Like, I actually installed a new light switch in my house, a new dimmer, for the first time. And I was able to do that so I could watch a video on YouTube that told me how to do it without killing myself. So that's collective intelligence, like, spreading back and forth, right? Okay.
Right.
So that said, in some experiments in animals, we are starting to see the ability to actually spread knowledge or spread some data from animal to animal, and it's kind of amazing, actually. So one of the more recent ones was these guys, Miguel Nicolelis, who's a famous researcher in brain computer interfaces. He and his team set up this study with a gimmick. Two rats in two identical mazes. One rat gets trained in how the maze works, which is how the maze works is there's a set of lights, and the lights go on in a certain pattern, and that pattern tells the rat which lever to pull. Okay? The other rat does not get trained in this pattern. Okay? The rats both have implants in their brains, in the motor cortex that controls their paws. And those implants are wired together, but the connection is not active. Okay? The gimmick is the rats, the cages are not next to each other. The cages are actually thousands of miles apart. One rat is in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The other rat is like 6,000 miles away in the Duke campus in North Carolina. Anyway, they activate the switch or the connection after rat one has been trained where it gets the answer right. It pulls the right lever like 100% of the time, nearly, or 90% of the time. And suddenly rat two, which gets the answer right half the time before that, starts getting the answer right way more often. Not 100%, but it starts getting the answer right like 70% of the time. Because there's information flow from rat one's brain.
Amazing.
So that,
I mean, that's very similar,
amazing,
actually, to what's described in the book, right? I mean, it's you know, down at the rat level, right? And it sounds like we haven't worked all the kinks out, but I mean, that's pretty much it, isn't it?
It's like version 0.001. It's proof of concept that we can do it.
Yeah. Wow. There you go. That's incredible. That's quite.
I mean, the implications of that are pretty profound, as discussed in Crux for those listening. Hey, I've got a question from the chat room. I want to come back to learning, and then we've got to hit our third big philosophical theme. But in the chat room, Jab asks whether you have tried modafinil, or the drug that the movie Limitless was based on. And do you have any comments on that?
I have tried modafinil. I did not immediately sleep with a model, go on a drunken bender, write a book. I wrote a book later, or run into a gangster. But
What did he write it in, like 12 hours? Right, he writes that book overnight.
Yeah.
Right.
Modafinil is great. I mean, modafinil is like it's a better version of caffeine, basically.
Okay.
Provigil is the brand name. The studies show that it has a better ratio of wakefulness to jitters than caffeine does. So you can take it. It allows you – it has a pretty long half-life, like 8 to 10 hours. So for that time, you're a little bit more alert. You're a little bit more able to stay awake. You can go to sleep while on it, and you definitely have less of that over-caffeinated feeling. It's a prescription-only drug, though it's pretty easy to get online from French pharmacies or whatever. It's a nice, mild enhancer.
What about these transmagnetic brain hacks? Have you tried any of that, juicing yourself up that way?
I have not tried transmagnetic stimulation, or the other one now is transcranial direct current stimulation. They both look pretty cool, actually. And there is stuff. Transmagnetic was the big one in vogue a few years ago, and now it's the transcranial direct current stuff is actually the one that's really hot. And there are some studies showing that you can do things like cut your learning rate by 20%, or cut your learning time. By 20%.
Yeah, let's not cut the rate, yeah.
Yeah, so it's boosting your rate by a quarter. So that's pretty awesome. I would like to see those studies replicated with more patients, you know, more subjects. And I would like somebody else who's more skilled than me to place the electrodes on my brain and to, like, wire the system and know that it's not going to, like, short out and deliver 10 times the current that I want.
That's the thing. You know, I read up on that, and I found the plans for it, and I was reading through it, and I was actually thinking about doing it. And then I was thinking, then I'm going to seriously take this electrical source and this wire and shock myself on that. I'm like, no, I really don't think that's a good idea. I couldn't. You know, knowing my own record with wiring my house, for example, I just didn't think it seemed like a great idea. I'm ready for that technology to be a little more, Jeffrey Moore, a little across the chasm, I think, before I'm gonna seriously try it. But that's me. I've always been kind of a late majority kind of guy when it comes to, I don't know, electricity in my head. Okay, so taking it back to the collective versus the individual. The downside is that there is this risk of being kind of subsumed into a group. At one point, one of our protagonists says something to the effect of, "Well, yeah, but what about me, the individual me person, right? What happens to her? I think it's her. I think it's Sam who asked that question. So, is it necessary? Does the next step in evolution require that the individual become less important because the group has become so much more important? Is that part of the dynamic that drives which we'll get into in the next conflict, which is the next theme, which is the conflict between human and post-human? Is that one of the basic differences that maybe in the post-human world the individual becomes less important? Ramez? Ramez, are you there?
Hey,
Ramez?
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
yeah,
I can.
Can you hear me now? Okay, sorry about that. Something fell off on my end, but now I'm back.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Did you hear my question?
I did, yeah. I think as the world gets bigger, each individual maybe is just a smaller part of it. But I don't think that the evolution of more things happening in groups makes individual is necessarily less important, or even if it does, at the same time that it makes each of us a smaller part, it at the same time makes us more empowered. All right, let me try to connect those two. These days, there are fewer and fewer Einsteins, let's say, which I don't mean that there's fewer people who are as smart as him. There's probably more people who are as smart as Einstein. But there are fewer scientific breakthroughs that happen by just one person thinking up something. The challenges that we work on are usually, they're usually multiple people working in large teams. You look at scientific papers, and they have long lists of people who worked on them. That's how things just happen these days, the same with most sorts of projects. But at the same time, the capabilities that we've built in the world mean that each individual is actually more empowered to go do things than ever before. I, as an individual, have more access to scientific data about the world than Einstein ever did.
Right.
I can go run simulations of star systems that he couldn't. Or Peter Diamandis, who founded the XPRIZE and runs Singularity University, likes to talk about how a African tribesman with a smartphone, which quite a few of them have, has more access to information than an American president 25 years ago did.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? So it's we all have to work more and more as part of networks. That's what's happened. It hasn't happened that fast. It's happened over the course of decades or even centuries in some ways. But I don't think that's diminished us. I think that's actually given us more individual capabilities and, in a lot of ways, more freedom.
So let's look at this then. If that's not the big conflict between human and post-human, or it shouldn't be, needn't be anyway. Let's talk about what is, because arguably the book describes the opening shots fired in what feels like this coming war between humanity and post-humanity. And roughly speaking, in the book, there are three groups, right? There's people waging war from the human side, and there's people waging war from the post-human side, and then there's people trying to keep the war from happening. You have these antagonists on either side who tend to see the other side as a threat, as the other, obviously, or they wouldn't want to be trying to fight with them. And the people trying to prevent the war see both sides as, you know, being in some sense valid and being worth protecting. Now, do you think that human enhancement will eventually lead us to that kind of divide that regular humans and augmented humans inevitably come to oppose each other the way religious or ethnic or ideological groups have in the past?
I hope not, and I don't think so. I was writing from a standpoint of, you know, the emotions and deep history and passions that get inflamed in ethnic divides, get inflamed in long-term conflicts that build up to terrorist sort of conflicts, the Israeli-Palestinian debate, even the debates or the conflicts that happened in Northern Ireland for so long, where people just get very steadfast in their viewpoint and the fight itself becomes the thing to a certain extent.
Right.
So I'm certainly exaggerating for effect. But I think that the most likely path is that enhancement just looks so attractive to most people that most people choose it. There's no war between the smartphone users and the non-smartphone users. Or if there is, it's a very kind of kind, you know, joshing. I have a couple of friends who don't want smartphones, and I might tease them occasionally, but we're not waging war on each other.
Right. Well, because inevitably we know that they're going to go extinct, right? There's no reason.
There is that. Now I will
they're on
say,
the way out.
Let me. I'll spin the kind of real world present day scenarios that I think are most troublesome, that have the high potential of leading in that direction.
Okay.
One is, in the book, the way that it happens is that there have been horrible things that have happened in this direction. So in the book, one of the backstories is that sometime in the 2020s, there was sort of a neo-Nazi geoengineering project that tried to create the new Ubermensch, and that was tied with a bioterror attack that killed thousands, and that led to a whole lot of mistrust in both directions. I don't think that's really going to happen, but you can sort of see how an event like that can color a nation's perceptions in the same way that 9/11 has colored perceptions in the U.S. for a long, long time and will
right.
continue to. I think the real thing that's happening right now that has a potential to have a kind of a bifurcating or splitting effect in society is technological automation. So for a long time, we have seen automation of manufacturing and other sorts of labor as increasing human wealth. But repeatedly, new ways of automation also threaten the welfare of people who have the jobs that are going away. And every time it's happened in the past, we've caught up. You know,
right.
So the Luddites are named after Ned Ludd, and Ned Ludd's claim to fame is that he smashed and led a group that smashed the steam-powered looms that were taking the place of the people who peddled non-steam-powered looms, because
right.
he thought these would, you know, destroy human jobs and lead to permanent unemployment. And that it turned out that just wasn't the case, because humans kind of moved up the ladder to higher value jobs that used more of our intellect. Okay.
Right.
Well, now there's a risk that this constant race between education or human skills and automation, for the first time, it's possible that automation is moving fast enough that humans might not be able to keep up. Now, we've always
right.
worried about that, and every time in the past we've been wrong. So we're probably wrong this time, but there's always a chance that we're right. So that's the thing that I worry about right now, is kind of the most likely to inflame something like what I wrote about, that would manifest differently than what's in the book.
Yeah, because that's not going to be around augmentation. That's really us versus the machines. And we've gone round and round about that one on this show, actually, over the last couple of years, because that is that does seem to be one of the real just transformative possibilities, not in a good way. I mean, just in a really uncertain and unsettling kind of future it opens up. But keeping on the idea of people becoming enhanced just for a sec,
mm-hmm.
One of the scary things is the question of you know, you talk about people becoming more capable, right? We're more integrated, but we're also more capable. Oh, and we're under 2 minutes here, so we're going to make this really quick. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you look at these amazing new capabilities to do good, but also to do harm, and you start to worry about, you know, what if a kid got a hold of this capability? What if a crazy person did? It's great. In Crux, we see both of those scenarios play out in the same family, right, which is really shocking, and you get some pretty scary results. Now, in the long run, do you think we have to be worried about crazy, megalomaniacal post-humans who think of themselves as gods? Are they going to represent a threat, or are we all going to be them?
You know, I don't worry about that with respect to enhancement. I worry about that with respect to other uses of the similar technologies. You know, I worry about bioterror. Bioterror right now is an insignificant threat. Anthrax can't kill as many people as falling appliances. But someday somebody could use DIY bio tools to create an infectious version of Ebola. Probably the first dozen times somebody tries, they'll fail. But that's the sort of thing that I think is much more of a threat than some, you know, augmented superhuman with super strength or super intellect.
All right. Well, that's going to have to be the last word, unfortunately. Tell us when the next book is coming out, and do you have a title yet? Some word meaning connection between two things with an X in it, I'm guessing.
The next book is called Apex, meaning the pinnacle of a connected network, and it
there
will come out next fall.
Next fall. Well, can't wait to see it. Looking forward to reading that. I can't believe we have to wait that long, but you know, we do have to give you time to write them, right? Until
Sorry,
machines
man.
Can take over that job.
Right. Hope not.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and we look forward to talking with you again real soon.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, our music this evening is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It's by The Bad Boys. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back again next week at the regular time. And until next time,
Live to see it.
Dropping dead.